better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
And we are live. Good Monday morning, folks, as we start out a brand new week. I thought it'd be fun to kind of go old school, new school at the same time. So what I have for you today are 10 technologies for the synthesis age. And what do I mean by the synthesis age? There's times in human history where we have technology kind of run away and propagate exponentially. And you think, well, you know, that's now, and it is, but it's not the only time. The industrial renaissance and basically second coming of the industrial age between the Civil War and World War I all the way up to World War II is another example of an extreme evolution of technology. If you just think about from the end of the Civil War to about 1910, all of the things that didn't exist that all of a sudden did exist, all of a sudden we're sending telegraph information across the ocean by that point. We are producing things in factories at a level that had never even been considered before with the adoption of both hydropower and hydroelectric power and electrical power as a whole. I mean, there were a lot of factories that were not even using electricity still in 1910, but most of them were, and you wouldn't have a factory very long after that if you didn't adopt that new technology. That took 50 years. What we're seeing happening in front of us right now is taking 10, 15 maximum to play out. All types of new technologies. And those technologies are varied. We have AI, of course, and we've talked about that a lot, but we also have all sorts of new investing technologies. We have the age of quantum computers. I think it's a little bit oversold, but there's no doubt that we're getting faster and better computers for less money today than any time in history. And that we're nowhere near peaking out on what that means for desktop and mobile level performance. We have tons of new high-tech solutions that are coming on. And biotechnology, we just talked about a lot of this stuff. But at the same time, old technology isn't going anywhere. It's still here and it's still being used, and it's actually becoming in some ways more important. As more and more of our invented jobs get replaced by AI, just as one example, humans will need to look for things to do. And AI is going to do a lot of things for us, but it's not going to produce nutrient-dense food, just as one example. It's not going to actually entertain us. If you look at what comes out of AI as entertainment, it's either really good for simp farming, I'll put it that way, or it becomes boring really fast. It's soulless. And I don't think we're going to get a soul into AI anytime soon. So creativity will remain important. And if you think about this, what I'm really talking about when I say the age of synthesis, or maybe the synthesis age would be a better way to say it. I'm not sure which one flows better, but you heard it here first. I think I coined it. It's actually a lot like modern survivalism, isn't it? Helping you live a life if times get tough, or even if they don't, using all the ancient technologies coupled with all the new technologies together. That way there's redundancy when the new technology fails, but we don't give up the advantages that the new technology can give us. It's almost like 17 years ago now, when I sat down and formulated what the survival podcast was going to actually be, and came up with the concept of modern survivalism. I knew what I meant, but the real output wasn't here yet. And I'm not saying that's one of my future-looking prognostications, because I didn't do it that way at all. I did it purely as a marketer. I thought that people would understand that it makes sense to be prepared for a disaster, but do so by putting things into your life that made you better off even if there wasn't a disaster. But when I really think about it all together, this pattern is now set. We have seen over and over. If you go back in history far enough, you can think about something like the printing press, right? The printing press was a very resistant technology. Does that sound familiar? It was dangerous. The peons will have access to the knowledge, right? And it caused an explosion of knowledge, but yet much of Europe remained rural and decentralized. Even in the Enlightenment, you had scientific breakthroughs happening alongside traditional farming and handcrafts actually experiencing their own renaissance. When people have more money because they're leveraging technology, they actually want to buy things that are higher quality, handmade, heirloom quality things. And right now there's a huge desire for quality over cheap in society, and it's becoming more and more prevalent. You know, 10 years ago, I never saw a meme of somebody posting like a picture of like a 25-year-old washing machine or refrigerator saying, today I would pay more money for the older technology that just works than all this smart technology that burns out in 5 years today. That just shows like memes are not the end-all be-all, but they do show the underlying current of emotion and feeling and desire. And I think we're hitting one of those definite inflection points. It's probably something we should have talked about a long time ago, because we've been talking about the inflection point of technology, you know, going parabolic for years. I said the decade of 2020 to 2030 would be the greatest period of flux that any living person's ever seen. I think maybe I was a little bit too optimistic, and it's maybe like slide that thing to 2025 to 2035. Like right now we're really entering it. And yet, if you think about it, 2020 maybe wasn't too early. Maybe it's just 15 years to play out instead of 10. Think about all the things that didn't exist in 2019 that exist today that we're using. AI tools would be one, but quantum computing actually is a thing now, and it was really just kind of like a sort of a thing maybe someday in 2018, 2019. There's so much new technology coming out right now, but a lot of it has been in the works for a while. And so I think we're hitting this point where we have this kind of, we are excited, most of us. Most of us aren't Luddites. We are excited about the future. Even if we know some of the things in it will be bad, we're excited about what we can grab onto, what we can leverage, and what we can do with technology going forward. And at the same time, think about this. I don't think there's been a time in the history of the United States from the days where the average person owned a car, family owned at least one car, up to today, I don't know that there's been a time in history that there's been more people, you know, growing gardens and homesteading per capita. Even during the Great Depression and the World War II Victory Gardens, for all the talk of it, I don't think it was what it is today. And I think it is, again, the synthesis. So if you think about it, like more and more people today are aware of the health risks of the modern food supply system. More and more people want to eat high quality food. But because of inflation, the high quality food costs a lot of money. And you can only afford to buy so much of it. So a natural response is to grow it yourself. So the information age leads to the low-tech age of growing your own food. However, it doesn't stop there, right? Like, so in 1985, if you wanted to put a garden in your backyard, unless you knew a nice old person who'd gardened their whole life, what did you do? Go buy a book? I mean, that's pretty much what you did. You either bought a book or you went to a library. You looked around, you tried to figure it out. What do you do today? You can go find 20 people gardening in an area pretty much in your climate, doing it 20 slightly different ways, and dial in what works for you, not just based on your climate, but what you like to eat, how much work you want to do, what you want it to look like. You can basically create anything you want today from a homesteading standpoint. Or if you want to get into aquaponics or hydroponics. I mean, back in the 80s, forget about it. There was almost no information on it at all. Today, you have a combination of these low-tech or highly, maybe they're not all low-tech either, but very highly approachable technology, something anybody can do. You don't need a computer degree. You don't need to know how to program an Arduino, though you might want to do it, but you don't need it. And yet we have this high-tech ability to gain information about how to do the things. That's what we're going to be talking about today. And from two vantage points, I want you to think two ways with this. Every single one of these can be something that you monetize as a business, as a product or service type business, or a product and service type business. And every single one of them is something you can do with no interest whatsoever in a part-time business, side hustle, any of it, and still benefit your own life. Now, I don't think anybody's going to really heavily do all 10 of the ones I'm going to give you today, but that's the beauty of freedom. And it's also the beauty of community. I see the best way for this to work is for more and more regional cell groups of people who have this ideology to start picking up one or two they can do and having internal commerce within that group. So if I'm the mushroom guy and you're the compost guy, we have a natural fit with each other, right? A very natural fit with each other. If I'm the biochar guy and you're the compost guy, we have a natural fit. If I'm an herb guy and you're the aquaponics guy, you could be the herb guy too. In fact, we have a natural fit. If I'm really good at formulating herbal compounds, then maybe I'm your customer for my business. Or maybe you're giving me herbs and I'm giving you product back. And one of the things to think about that we really need to think about with this kind of parallel economy stuff is I think I'm part of it. I think it's been way oversold for way too long that we have tried to sell the parallel economy as a replacement and competitor of the larger macro economy. And I don't see it happening. I don't think it needs to. I think 10,000 small groups trading just a little bit with each other is more powerful than a website of all the supposed alternative economy, which is just basically small business people selling into the larger economy. That's my thoughts. Anyway, before we get into all this and go through these 10 technologies, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. But even before we do that, just a real quick reminder, Laws of Life, my book, Ditch the System, Design Your Life, is now available without all the screwed up errors. I'm not going to say there's not a typo or three in it, but most of them are gone and the formatting's better and everything's great, which means if you have one of the original ones, you now own a collector's item. But please consider picking up the corrected version, or you can listen to the audio version on the audiobook. Just know the audiobook is read by AI, and I'm working on the second book right now, and I've learned a lot in this experience. And one of the things is the AI thing will pronounce some things improperly, so I am making sure that in the new book it will be prepared for that reality. For instance, if you put 80S for 80s, the AI says 80S. So you write out the word 80s. Things like that, I just want you to know, are, you know, a little bit of an issue with it. But hey, you guys wanted it. I also want to tell you something real quick, too, about the whole audiobook thing. I'm so glad I didn't take up anybody on an offer to record it or professionally produce it for money or whatever. There seems to be no money in the audiobook format for the producer. When you buy an audiobook with like an Audible credit and you pay nothing for it, the person that produces it apparently doesn't get anything. Now, maybe when they finally process my payments, there's some back way I'm not seeing it. But right now, I look like I'm making very little money on audiobooks. And the price I set the book for doesn't actually control the price it gets sold at in some ways. And because of that, it doesn't seem to be as profitable as either Kindle or print book. So I don't know how some of these authors are able to afford the high quality professional production unless I'm just missing something. And again, you don't get your, like, I won't get a dime actually paid to me till around the first week of August from the sales in May. That's how long it takes to get paid by KDP. All right, with that, sponsor day number one today is the Berkey guy with usaberkeyfilters.com. Water is one of the most important things in the world, and you want to drink the safest, highest quality, and best tasting water you can get, then you want to put your water through a Berkey. I don't care who you are either. I mean, we're on a well. I worry very little about my water getting contaminated. I do always point out, if you don't test your own well water, then you won't know if it's contaminated. But my water is 160 foot under limestone. But you know what? When the water comes out of the Berkey, it just tastes better. So that's why I do it. But if you're on city water, just remember that you never know. I mean, you absolutely never know when that water gets contaminated. When they give you that boil water order, it's almost always the case that problem's been around a while before they figured it out. I'm just saying. Next up today is Biltong USA. That's from Anton. And you can get some of the best Biltong that I've ever had. Honest to God, it really is. Is it as good as mine? I don't know. Okay, that's hard for any Biltong maker to admit, but it's damn good. And the value compared to things that you could buy like on Amazon is, it's not, you can't even compare it. First of all, most of the product that's called Biltong that's sold retail is garbage. It's over-dried jerky. It's not Biltong. Biltong is cured. It's not dried. It's dry cured, but it's not dried, if that makes sense. What I mean is it shouldn't be dry. It should be moist in the interior. See how the picture there, it looks like a rare steak. That's what it should look like. It should have, the outside should, like if you have the whole piece before it's cut, it should feel kind of hard, but when you cut into it, it should cut more like prosciutto. right? That's what it should be like. Anton knows how to make it because he's from South Africa. He also has a lot of other really great stuff. And hey, he's hanging out with us right now. Is that serendipitous or what? All right. So with that, let's go ahead and dig on into the main topic today. We had a pretty long intro, so I'm going to try to get right into the topic. Just give me just a second here. But again, I just want to reiterate, the pattern is set. This has all happened before. We have had these major technological leaps many times throughout history, and it has always been the case that everybody always says what? Oh, everything that was is going to be eaten. It's going to be gone. It won't be there anymore, you know? From the days of the printing press to people actually not using cursive writing, handwriting, took about several hundred years. Like, I grew up learning how to write cursive and being graded for it like it was an art, right? Like, my writing is messy, so I would get like C's in handwriting when I was in like second grade in Catholic school. So did we finally kill cursive? I think a lot of people still know how to do it, but I don't think we're teaching it to kids anymore, and only kind of weird, geeky people will bother to learn it. But how long did it take? And people are still going to print. So how long did it take for that technology to make something go away that people probably thought was going to be gone very, very soon? Forever, almost. I mean, you're talking centuries. And this has always been the case. Like, when the sawmills were invented, well, the sawmen are not going to have jobs. The sawmen's jobs changed, and nobody really wanted to be down in the pit, literally with a rip saw, with sawdust going down the crack of your ass, cutting boards out of a tree anyway. It was just how they made money, and they rioted when the first sawmills started firing up in the UK. But there's more jobs in timber today per capita in the world than there ever was. And so this is always the case, that the old world and the new world collide, and then they kind of both go on anew. And so this would also be like, you could call this neo-homesteading, right, which is the new homesteading. It'd be another way to look at it. But I didn't want to call it that because it implicates a lot of political bullshit that I don't want to implicate into this. So each of these technologies, again, they can benefit you as a business or simply as a life skill. And I would be remiss if I didn't say, you know, some of these kind of go into the food world, and like the small scale custom production food product like Anton, King of Biltong right here, right? This gentleman that is a sponsor today, that's another example that these feed into. Or I have a really cool announcement coming soon. If you've ever heard of Kentucky Rebel Scum Hot Sauce, they're about to be an MSB discount vendor. That's a guy right out of our community that built a business making hot sauce in his kitchen and had to finally go to the, like, get small-scale commercial approval from the local government to up his production to where he could stop, like, making all of it he could for a batch and then selling it all in 5 minutes and not having any for a while. Like, he's actually up to a production run capacity now. So you can start seeing how there's other things that tee off of this. The other thing I want you to realize is almost every one of these will directly plug into 2, 3, 4, or maybe all the others. These all pattern together because they're all from the same concept, which is new tech, old tech, meeting together and working together. And the last one is going to be like, that's high tech. It is, but it also enables all the low tech if you do it right. So the first one today is mushrooms. And obviously, whenever I get into something, I get into it hardcore and I start learning a lot about it. And then I'm going to talk about it. I've done it with so many things. Biochar, composting. Both of those are on the list, by the way. Vermicomposting, aquaponics, hydroponics. And now I'm doing it with mushrooms because I always want to know more. I always want to try a new thing. I always want to decide, like, is this really worth doing or not? And it's sometimes it's not. Here's an example, straw bale gardening. I know some of you will hate me for this. Did it work? Yeah. Was it worth it? No. No, it wasn't. It wasn't worth it at all. The amount of energy that went into making the bale able to grow food and for the duration it would grow after that and with the results not really being much better, I didn't think it was worth it. Now, if you do, that's fine. I'm just saying I go through a lot of this stuff and determine what I think is worth going forward with. Mushrooms have been great. One of the big things is it's fast, high-yield protein and medicinal production. We don't even have a freaking clue some of the medicinal things that mushrooms would be able to do for us. And this includes like the psilocybin stuff, like the magic mushrooms, and what that's able to do for people with mental issues. Like there are trials that have been done where basically people are given a capsule form, known quantity of these psychoactive mushroom compounds, and they're given them one pill, and they stay, you know, like someone stays with them, like this is done in a supervised environment, and they give them the pill, and they have their experience, and then 3 months later, they give them another pill, and then 3 months later, they give them another pill, and then they're done. And some people who have been chronically dealing, struggling with mental illness problems like depression, they're done. Now, obviously, you know who you don't have to worry about competing with us in that world? Merck, Johnson & Johnson, all these giant, there's no money in that for them. All these molecules are in the public domain if they're synthesized or they're naturally available from mushrooms that grow all over the world. All the data is in the public domain and you can't make money, right? You can't make money by making something that somebody takes three pills and then they're done for the rest of their life when anybody anywhere could make those pills. So there's not going to be a lot of competition there from the big boys, but I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity. And then, you know, some of the well-known medicinals, turkey tail, lion's mane, cordyceps, like there's a tremendous opportunity there as well. And then there's the whole, just the food production capacity. And I don't get vegans. I'm not going to beat them up or anything. I'm just, I don't understand, but I will tell you that one of the few ways that a vegan can get all the amino acids that they need without having to take pure supplements is mushrooms, because mushrooms with the right combinations and then adding some other combinations like corn, bean, and rice, you can at least get a full complement of the essential amino acids. And for those who don't know what that means, essential means you need it and you can't make it. That's what makes it essential, that you consume it. So there's a whole bunch of amino acids that we can synthesize from other amino acids. But there's a list of them, these are all proteins, that we need to survive and be healthy, and we cannot make. And mushrooms like oyster mushrooms have all of them. They also offer micro-remediation for soil and toxin cleanup. There's a lot going on, and again, I said these overlap. Like Billy Bond is working with people that are still doing soil remediation from Hurricane Harvey and what happened in the Carolinas. And that is utilizing fungi. It's using mycelium. It's using inoculated biochar and wood chips, and it's doing a fantastic job of cleaning up this highly toxic shit. Well, there's also money in that. I believe you might have an opportunity with even small companies doing this micro remediation in more urban environments, selling even to possibly government organizations, like small towns and stuff, where they have these problems and they know they need to do something about it, where this stuff can be cleaned up. The big thing, though, is it's minimal space and input requirements. I'm using the Boom Room from North Spore. I have a whole crap. I think I have 8 new blocks to put into it today, and some of the ones that have been through a couple times are going to go out and get buried in the garden. But I'm producing right now an average of 4 to 5 pounds of mushrooms a week. And my footprint to do that is about 3 foot by 2 foot by about 6 foot high. That's damn impressive. And I'm not even good at it yet. I've learned some things this week. Some of you that saw me producing mushroom mycelium in like quart jars and the little plastic tubs and then fruiting them straight in that way. Yeah, don't do it. It's not worth it. It's not worth it. They produce so little as far as a flush, that it's not, unless you had 10 of them going, it's really not something you could do with it. It would be easier to just build back. So I have a whole new way, and I'll be sharing with you guys. I'm trying to come up with ways people can do this without specialized equipment, even if it's specialized equipment. And so a lot of you guys out there own, for instance, a sous vide machine and a vacuum sealer, because you've been long-time listeners and you use those for other things. Instead of buying specialized gear, I always like to see, can we take something we already have and multitask it? So mushrooms are going to be that type of thing. And I'll tell you that this is a huge growth industry. It's something that's completely open. You almost can't not find customers. I've never seen an industry where people already in it are so receptive to other people becoming part of it. Usually most industries they see, like if I run a landscape business and a guy down the road that I know starts a landscape business, like it's almost fighting terms, right? Fishing guides, they want to, you know, that's my lake. Bitch, it ain't your lake. It's 60,000 acres. It's anybody's lake, you know? Mushrooms and beekeepers. They seem to be the people like, what do you need? I got extra equipment that I don't use anymore. You want it? Hey, you want my spent blocks? You can do that to get started. Like, there's competition, but it's not. It's like very actual friendly competition. And it's just a space that's only going to get bigger. I have a book I want to recommend right now that I'm listening to on audio. And it's by Paul Stamets, but it's not. It's called Fantastic Fungi. And when I say it's by Paul Stamets, but it's not, Paul probably writes one third of the chapters, and about two thirds of the chapters are written by others like Trad Cotter and other really great people. It's a fantastic book, and it's one that I think will really work well for you in an audio if you like audiobooks. So I'll make sure I add a link to the show notes today when we're done here today. Moving on, let's talk about herbs. See, herbs and mushrooms really have this functional overlap because they're both medicinal and culinary. Herbs are a functional medicine that are, to me, a birthright of humanity. It's something that anybody can do and probably everybody should learn a little bit about. There's probably not, in the summertime, between the ants and the mosquitoes and the wasps, there probably isn't a week that goes by that one of us in this house is not putting comfrey and plantain on something. Or the kids get scraped up and scratched by stickers and briars and stuff playing out like kids are supposed to do. Same thing. We go ahead and use a little bit of like a mixture of plantain, sometimes plantain lantana and comfrey. This is not something that one needs to go to chemistry school to learn how to do. This is something like I learned a lot of this stuff from my grandfather when I had one digit to my age, and I was able to do it because it is that simple, and much of it is very, very safe. But we can also turbocharge it by intentionally growing things and making multiple value-added products from them, whether it's just for us or it's for putting out into the world. And what I mean by that is we can grow these herbs, and we can use all of the products of them internally, or maybe just share them with neighbors, or we can build a business or component of a business on top of them. A lot of people want to grow herbs, and you know, producing herbs and then selling the plants for others to grow is just another form of plant propagation. So there's another overlap in technology there. The culinary value is huge, though. It's, you know, you got people like John Dowie, a lot of his microgreens are actually microgreens of herbs, right? Like arugula or like microgreen basil selling in restaurants. But I think there is a total market for someone growing herbs that are more in clumps to sell to restaurants. Like I remember the one chef we were selling eggs to, and I really didn't want to go and expand the business into herbs. But at the same time, I was doing hydroponics. And I was growing red vein sorrel. And I was, you know, able to, in about 20 days from seed, maybe 20, 25 days, produce these beautiful clumps about the size of your hand of perfect baby, not micro, but baby leaf red vein sorrel. So each clump probably had about, you know, 50 beautifully perfect shaped, all about the same size leaves in it. I showed that to our chef that was buying our duck eggs. He's like, how much of this can I get? I'm like, I'm not going to produce enough of this to be a reliable supplier. I just wanted to know what your opinion was. He goes, I would buy that, and I would use that in my salads, and I would use it forever, and I cannot buy something that looks like that. That's just another example of how the culinary side of this works. Plus, and I've done herbal shows before, when we use fresh herbs in our cooking, we're getting all the medicinal effects just by eating them. And this is how humans lived for so long in history. We would figure out the things to add to our foods that made them taste better, like rosemary or oregano or thyme, right? All these like basic culinary herbs. And lo and behold, every single one of them, when actually researched, has antimicrobial, antiviral, antibiotic effects, tonifying effects. There's a list of 40 herbal actions that are also the same actions that many of our pharmaceutical drugs have. And I've done whole shows on those. I think there's four shows breaking down to 10 actions per show. That did a long time ago. If you're in herbs, you might want to look those up and learn from them. And the other side of it is, if you're going to be a small business, you can't make low margin. Okay? Simple. If you're going to have a small business, you cannot succeed with low margins. It's not possible. Because you have to be a big business to do a lot of sales to succeed with low margins. That's why even places where they make, you think they make a lot of money, like a gas station. A gas station cannot survive on the margins you make selling gas. That's why they all have, you know, your gas station is either also kind of like a service shop. There's not many of those anymore. That's what my dad did. He sold tires. They did oil changes. And that was about it. If you came in like, I need my belts replaced or something, like if you needed to get down the road, he might jerry rig it for you so you can go somewhere else. But they didn't do automotive work. They did tires, oil changes, and sold gas. And that was a model in the 80s and the 70s. Today, though, every gas station is also what? It's a convenience store, right? So even that's a, no, convenience stores are big business, but they're really not individually. So even they have to have a high margin product to make it. Herbs are freaking high margin. Herbs are high margin. The next time you're in the grocery store, all I want you to do is go look at the cheapo, like McCormick brand dry herbs. Look at the price of a little bottle of something like oregano and convert it to pounds and see how much a pound of dried oregano is at the grocery store. This is why I buy any herb that I can't grow in mass that I use a lot of. I buy it by the pound organic on Amazon because it costs me about twice as much to buy a pound as it does to buy a half an ounce. Because it's that high margin of a product. So if you get to where you can build a customer base for herbs and herbal product, you have a high margin product. And that means you can make enough money to make it worth being in business as a small business. Can you make enough money to pay a salary to yourself and not work another job or have more to your business? I don't know. Some people can, some people won't be able to. It all depends on what you want to do, but it's doable because it's high margin. The next one is biochar. Now we've talked a lot about this. This is one of my real passions because I've seen what it can do for the environment and for people and for farms. I've seen how it can take a project that's almost profitable and make it very profitable by adding it as a component of what you're doing. If you really understand what biochar does, you get that it's more than it's just long-term carbon storage, but it's also soil enhancement and a tool for bioremediation. The beauty of the carbon storage thing really is that the government is stupid, and there are all kinds of programs that enable small farmers to make biochar and sell the credits without even selling the char. Now, this is being done more in the third world right now than it is being done in the developed world. But, I mean, just for instance, Microsoft has a has an order out or a bid out right now, still never been filled because there's not enough biochar available in the world that qualifies for what they want to buy because they want the carbon credits. They don't give a shit. They might not even use it. They might just donate it to somebody else. And that's what's going on in some of these, you know, smaller third world countries. The farmers are being like, people are going in, they're teaching them to make biochar from their waste product. They're teaching them how to inoculate it. They're teaching them then how to improve their farms with it. And then they're getting paid for doing the work to improve their own farm because another company that needs the carbon credits is buying X number of tons of biochar per year or per quarter in the carbon trading scheme. Do I think that's good in of itself? No, but the result is good. Like, they piss money away on everything anyway, right? They steal all the time anyway. At least in this instance, you're getting something that's improving soil for thousands of years. I'll take it. I'll take the win. And there's lots of ways that it can be bent and twisted like that. Remember, we will not defeat the state by fighting them head on. We have to use state as jiu-jitsu. And when they basically, what they've done with biochar and all the opportunity that comes with it, it's like your opponent in a grappling match, and you're both standing up, and he reaches out and he grabs you by your two shoulders and he stops. Anybody that's ever taken, you know, wrestling, judo, jiu-jitsu knows that dude's fixing to be toast. He just gave you two, like, you immobilized yourself and you've given the opportunity for someone to grab, twist, and manipulate a joint. Like, if you throw a punch at a judo guy and you don't pull it back like a jab and you leave it out there, you're screwed. You're about to find out what hits harder than a punch, the ground. And that's kind of what they've done with biochar. They have opened up so many ways in that you can manipulate that state of jiu-jitsu that it's totally worth doing. But it does all these other wonderful things, supporting microbial life. It helps retain nutrient and water. So this is beneficial. Make it and put it in your own garden the way that I taught you how to do, with proper inoculation, of course. It enhances the value and the quality of compost. You know what else you can do? You can take about 10% of the total volume of your grow box and mushrooms and put it in there. And it enhances fungal growth while making the waste product as a compost more valuable. And if you structured it right, maybe there's a carbon credit in there somewhere for like a place that uses 80 blocks a day. I don't know. You have to figure it out for yourself. Maybe go into like Google Gemini, put it in deep think mode and give it all this information and see what comes out. The old ancient technology overlapping the new and led by the new, right? Because a lot of what we're doing with mushrooms is very new technology, less than 100 years old. Less than 100-year-old technology is new. I know it's hard to believe, but it is. A lot of it's less than 25 years old. Those things we're doing with like liquid cultures now and sterile individual cultures, like that's something that with plants as well, tissue culturing is a totally different world, but yet it's for the old thing, right? Next, you know, the big thing about biochar is it can be made from waste product that's everywhere. There's 100 ways to come up with how to monetize this and do less work yourself. If you build a system or buy a system that can char wood chips, you have an almost unlimited source somewhere around you. If you use low-tech kilns, all you need is dry wood, whether it's prunings, whether it's cutoffs. I know a guy that was making it out of the cutoffs from lathe-turned baseball bats. He was getting like 4 50-gallon drums of those a week for free. They're like, we're not going to charge you for this. I mean, we have to get rid of it. And it's like white ash. Like, it's like perfect hardwood, all the same size. Beautiful for making it out of. Or, you know, talk to a tree company that does tree trimming. They never have any way to get rid of all their slash. They make wood chips. Again, you need some way to process wood chips. Or just cutting and pruning. Or talk to somebody with an orchard. You know, you might be able to get them to do all the cutting, and you come in with a mobile kiln like Kelby's Ring of Fire and provide it to them as a service. You don't even have to move it. Like, when you're done with it, here it is. Now you use it. There's a thousand ways to do this. And of course it overlaps with biological composting as well, which we'll get to in a minute. And how about water plants? There's so much work to be done with water plants that we haven't even really begun to understand yet. And a lot of it is being impeded, as always, by the Department of Making You Sad. So let me tell you how I ended up using a plant called water hyacinth, which is, you know, on the list of bad plants that you're not supposed to grow, at least in Texas, and acting like a place that USDA is on 7 like I'm in, which by the way, is like the Carolinas, okay, is the same as like south of Houston, is ridiculous. The state just bans things across the board. But water hyacinth, I actually learned about, I read a study, and it was done in Canada, at a commercial duck egg operation. And so these ducks are on hard surfaces, and they just simply wash all the shit off the hard surface, and then the ducks go into more of a good place to lay, because you don't want a bird laying on concrete. So they have like more like commercial versions of a chicken house, right? Like a homesteader chicken house with a soft material to lay in. And then they come out, and they spend most of their day on this hard surface. This is awful. And then all this effluent has to be washed away. Well, it goes into these lagoons, and these lagoons, as you might imagine, are nasty. So some researcher gets an idea, like, how can we process this naturally? And they're like, well, we could use this plant called water hyacinth. It's invasive. It's Canada. It can't invade. It can only survive for about 6 months out of the year, and then it dies. And that happens to also be when the ducks are in their highest production of eggs. And so that's when they're eating the most. That's when they're shitting the most. Like, let's try this. So they put the water hyacinth in the lagoons, completely took over really, really fast. And then the water coming out of the lagoons was cleaner than the water that was going into the duck house. Not after it was shitting it, obviously. Like, the water supply, when they tested it, was less clean than the effluent coming out the end of the lagoon system. That's why I built the system behind my duck coop. My 16 by 8 in-ground frame pond, that whole system, and then it has all the cascades and all, and they all grow water hyacinths, and all the water hyacinths goes to the ducks for feed. It's exactly what they were doing. I just small-scaled it. That's one thing you can do with a water plant. One, right? We can turn azolla into compost with no other material. It's a carbon and nitrogen in one. It's a nitrogen-fixing floating fern. It provides its own nitrogen. We don't even need a nitrogen source to grow it. We just need the right conditions, which is the right water temperature and enough sun and not too much. And you can't stop it from growing once you have that, if there's any nutrient load in the water at all. It's a high-speed biomass generation. Water plants are some of the best compostables that you can make. So just the ability to rapidly produce a massive amount of biomass that can be composted has value, even if it's not a direct livestock feed. And a lot of these can be combined, again, these different technologies. So if you can grow azolla and you put the azolla in a black soldier fly bin, the black soldier flies eat it like candy. So hold on to that thought till we get over to the composting one. But there's other things that we could be doing here, not just compost, animal feed, and or a hybrid thereof. What about unique edibles? And of course, this would cross over and fit really nice with aquaponics or hydroponics, right? So what do I mean by unique edibles? There's a plant that if you produce it, I guarantee you can sell all of your production if you have any Asian communities around you. It's called duck potato, or arrowhead, I think is what they call it, arrowhead root. And we have a native variety in America of our duck potato, and they get about, they're a little, you know, the biggest ones are bigger than a quail's egg, but smaller than a chicken's egg. The ones that come from Asia, which is what the Asian community really wants, and they really like to eat them for some reason around New Year's, they get big. I mean, bigger than an egg, bigger than a chicken's egg, maybe like about the size of a big duck's egg, not quite the size of a goose egg. And they're delicious, easy to grow plant. And if you have aquatic systems, you can grow as much as you want, or you can have a carbohydrate crop for yourself. And they're all, because they're a water plant, they're any water plant, if you have the right environment for it, is inherently low maintenance, because your biggest workload is usually irrigation and weeding. And water plants will outcompete just about all weedy species in a water plant environment, and you don't need to irrigate them because they're water plants. Another one would be water chestnut. Water chestnut is the most productive product by square foot of plant in the world. Nothing edible can produce more weight per square foot than a water chestnut. And there's an immediate market. Again, it's mostly the Asian market, but there's a lot of opportunity out there for people that would like something other than a canned version of this. It's hard to find them fresh. And if you specialize in them and you grow really big ones, which is what I grow, they're easy to peel, and you could probably build a business on that, or a piece of a business on something like that, or just produce them like I do for yourself. Or what about wasabi? Wasabi is incredibly expensive. It's a water plant. If you're like, I eat wasabi all the time because I go get sushi, unless you're going to a very high-end sushi restaurant that is specifically proud of the fact that what they're serving you is actual wasabi, you're not eating wasabi. You're eating horseradish and green food coloring and some mustard. That's what you're eating. That's what that powdered green shit is. It is not wasabi. Wasabi is incredibly unique unto itself. It has that horseradish hit, but it's nowhere near as hard, and it has a sweetness to it. This is an incredibly valuable plant, and it's been difficult to grow commercially for a long time. And it turned out that the reason it was difficult to grow commercially is people that figured out how to do it had no interest in telling anybody how to do it. Well, now on YouTube University, there's lots of people that know how to do it. It's not that hard. It just requires a few little tweaks. So that's something you can look into as well. You got natural filtration, gray water systems, high-speed biomass, animal feed, compost inputs. You've got unique edibles. You've got, I mean, our entire companies, all they sell is water plants. Now, they're selling ornamentals as well, like lilies and what have you. You know, you got other plants like Lotus. Lotus produces several different edible components, and it's very highly sought after, very unique high-end applications, right? And some of this stuff, like what you really would want to do is build a book of business with very upscale restaurants. That would be one of the better ways that you could do this. Like, if you go into a restaurant and you have to stand and order at a counter, that is not the right place. And if it's a chain, it's not the right place. Not a national chain anyway. What about aquaponics? Well, everything I just said can be done in an aquaponics or hydroponic system. I kind of combined them here to keep this manageable on time today. But again, with aquaponics and hydro, we get into stackable, space-efficient food production. So we can build indoor systems with complete climate control where we completely utilize the vertical space by pumping water up and letting it fall back down. That means we can, I mean, there is a 2-acre greenhouse operation primarily sells to restaurants in Dallas-Fort Worth. It's over in Dallas. I've always wanted to get over and tour the place. But they are running 2 acres of hydroponic greenhouse on two main pumps, because they throw the water to one side and they let it come back to the other, and that's all that it really takes. So they're running 2 acres on two pumps, a pump an acre. I do think they have some other smaller pumps here and there for some specific applications, but the primary energy use is only these two pumps. You know, and if they're anything like the pumps I'm using, and they're probably a little more powerful, I have pumps that are moving 3,000 gallons an hour, and they're running on 87 watts of power. So it's incredibly efficient. All of the talk that it's not efficient is bullshit. It's energy waste or whatever is bullshit. People saying it, they just don't like it, so they'll come up with crap to talk shit about it. I've done enough of this. I can tell you it's incredibly productive. So you have the space efficiency with vertical space you can expand. So 1 square foot on 4 levels becomes 4 square feet. So an acre becomes 4 acres is one way to look at it. But there's more to it than that. The planting density can be so much higher because you're bringing everything the plant needs right to it. So the only thing you have to worry about with density is that you're far enough apart that the plants get the light they need for what they want to do. So you can't go planting, you know, tomato plants every 2 inches and have a productive system. But a lot of things that you normally would need to put, let's say, 18 inches between, we can bring that spacing down to more like 9, cut that in half. So we double the density and triple the layers. And so the amount of production we can do, plus by being indoors or in partial climate control, we can extend the season to year-round or near year-round. A lot of people in these businesses, they could run year-round, but they run something like 10 months. And they tend to kind of shut down. They sell through December, and they kind of just take off January and February. And agriculture has typically had kind of that rest period in it. It's where you fix all the equipment and just kind of take a break from running super, super hard all the time, you know. It's also closed loop nutrient cycling, especially in the aquaponics system, where you actually can free up the need for very much input at all. I mean, if you're doing aquaponics and you have a worm farm, you really don't need any input at all. Occasionally, you might need to do a little bit of balancing of your pH or a little bit of micronutrient balancing, but overall, you're pretty much done just from that. That's all that it really takes. And from there, we're going to go on to something completely different, lactofermentation. There's a whole cottage food industry waiting to happen. And lactofermentation is one of the places that you might make more money teaching people how to do it than doing it for them. I mean, honestly, like running little clinics and stuff like that, like not everything needs to be a big business. But this is actually the one that makes the most sense out of all of them to me to mostly do for yourself or to do for very high-end clients only. And on that note, I made something this weekend that just came out amazing. Now, this one's not a lactoferment, but it could have been. I wanted to guarantee this would work, and I wanted to test it fast because I honestly plan to use this at TSP25, and I wanted to make sure it was going to work. If you're on the video right now, the picture you're looking at in that jar, right, those are fennel flowers. And they're fennel flowers that were all cut off the plant right at the peak of before they open, and they're starting to produce pollen. So they have the fennel pollen on them, and they're not quite open. And they haven't formed seeds yet. And I cut the entire cluster heads off. I put them in that jar. I did a very weak pickle on that, one part vinegar to three parts water, and some other things, pink peppercorn, lemon and orange peel, and some other stuff, right? But that could have very easily been a lactoferment. Now, I actually plan for these, little giving a little bit away about the coming fall workshop, I'm doing some things with pickling and fermenting mushrooms. And I'm coming up with, since Ken Daniels is going to be there, some side stuff. This won't be for dinners. This will be like little mini kind of workshop going on over here, and you can come in and taste three or four different things. And I have made those because I started pulling those off the plant and eating them, and they were sweet and fennel-y, but they were also a little bit bitter, and they kind of made me think of capers. And I'm like, ooh, there's something to this. So this is, I have a recipe that I'm not going to share yet for an hors d'oeuvre type, like an amuse-bouche, that involves oyster mushrooms and those and some other things. But again, that could easily be a lactoferment. Lactofermentation extends your shelf life and brings that probiotic value to you. It also preserves the harvest with no energy inputs. So even what I just showed you, it was easy. When I told my wife I was going to pickle fennel flowers, she's like, oh, it's going to be all day. It was like 15 minutes. It took me longer to fill the jar up with them than it did to actually do it. It's like mix the ingredients, stuff the jar, put the ingredients on the stove, bring it to a rolling boil, pour it over the stuff in the jar, put the lid on it, and you're done. This was not canning, right? I didn't process it. I wanted it lightly pickled, so this is stored in the refrigerator, but almost an indefinite shelf life that way. So very, very easy to do, but it still required an energy input. I had to boil. Lactofermentation requires nothing but salt and product and creativity and time and management, right, so that you don't overdo it. It also enhances flavor and nutrient density. And again, I see the potential to come up with 5 to 10 really unique lactofermented items and hook up with, let's say, 10 to 20 very high-end restaurants and be the supplier for that. And the beauty of doing that is you can then normalize your production schedule. You normalize your production schedule. This, by the way, is the real reason I think a lot of the mushroom guys give away their spent blocks. More on that when we get to composting. It's not so much that the second flush won't be as big. It's not predictable. So what I want to be able to do if I'm running a business is I want to be able to say I'm going to have, you know, 200 pounds of oysters, 200 pounds of lion's mane, 30 pounds of maitake, you know, whatever it is. Like, I want to know exactly how much production that I have coming out per day and per week. If I'm going to have a day off, I don't want anything needing to be done on that day that can't be done with automation. I don't want any harvesting or whatever. I want to be able to know I put this in, and then X days later, this comes out. By always using blocks that they've come up with their own method, their own inoculation, their own incubation period, and they have complete control over it, they know that if I put this block in, it's going to fruit on this day. And if it's off by a day or two, there's enough of overlap of that that, okay, we'll take some from this and then this will come forward. If I take that block and go to fruit it again, I don't have a predictable result. And if I'm working at that level, I'm not buying them for $28 a block, guys. Okay. I'm making them for a buck or two. And it's just easier to let that go do something else somewhere else and bring in another unit. And that's the same thing I'm saying with this fermented food thing. If you knew exactly what you're producing and for whom, and again, this is a high-end product, because let me tell you something. When you're selling to a restaurant, like Dorothy and I, about once every 3 months, go to like a really high-end place. It's just something I do for her because she deserves it. So we hadn't been to a place called Riata in downtown Fort Worth in a long time, and they're at a new location because I had to move again. And I took her there. When you're talking to people at that level of a restaurant, they're not worried about $2. And if they are, you need to talk to somebody else, right? You're not going to be like, you know, well, 18 a jar, can you get to 16? Like, you're not going to deal with that with those people, because you're trying to hit them with something where they go, oh my God, I know 10 things I can do with that. How much can I get? At that point, as long as you're being fair with your price, the prices move. So that's the kind of way to scale these businesses and how to stack them together and cobble them together to make enough revenue with high margin to make it worth doing, or keep it a small side hustle. It's up to you, or just bring it into your own life. But the lacto-fermentation, I think there is some commercial possibility for it. But the real value is for home production, home and community level production, because it is so simple and anybody can do it. And it brings so much nutrition to you. It's one of the commonalities. When Dr. Weston Price traveled all over the world to all these indigenous remnant societies and said they were all really healthy, they had excellent dental health, they had no obesity, no chronic modern diseases at all. And he said, well, what's the commonalities? One was they all highly valued animal protein and fats, okay, and animal products that were high in fat, like yogurts and cheeses. And two was that they always, and I mean always, had a fermented food or three or four in their diets. None of them were, like, he couldn't find anybody that didn't have some keystone food that they relied on heavily that was fermented. All of them had it. He also, by the way, he tried really hard. He believed that he would find a vegan indigenous society with high health. He never found one. And it wasn't biased, because he was actually disappointed by not being able to find one. He wanted to find one. There just wasn't. It's just something to think about. Moving on, how about bioactive composting? Well, I mean, technically all composting is biological. High-term thermophilic compost is biological, but you guys know what I mean, right? Bioreactor-style composting would be one example of that. Composting that has integrated pest management in it, and this is often done with things like vermicomposting. So I listened to one gentleman during Matt Power's last kind of big online seminar thing, and he was an integrated pest management guy. And integrated pest management means you're actually introducing the beneficial predators that eat things that you don't want in your garden. And he had a whole little kit, basically, that you just put it in your mushroom, or not your mushroom compost, you put it in your verma bin, and then when you were harvesting the vermicompost, you already had infused with this life, and they had no direct competition with the worms. So that's using IPM within composting. I'm sure there's other ways to do that as well. Worm composting, hugely, hugely valuable. And again, see how approachable this all is? Who can't do worm bins? Who can't compost with worms? Who can't get free material to give worms to eat to make compost? Take a drive by your local Starbucks and tell them you want coffee grinds. And you well, can I come back and get them? No, hold. Here's a giant. The only problem is they're heavy and wet, right? It's a lot of weight to carry out of there. But you can get all of, like, or go buy a Jamba juice and see if you can get the waste from the fruit, like all of the, after it's juiced. There's so many places that you can get free food for worms or free food for black soldier flies, and you can turn garbage into money. I mean, think about, like, remember, like, how it was, like, so kind of quirky and funny, and that doesn't work in the Back to the Future films. And at the end of the first one, Doc comes back and says, we got to go back to the future this time instead of back to the past. Because, you guys turned okay, but your kids are assholes, basically. And we got to fix the future. And they're like, well, you got plutonium. And he, like, puts banana peels in the DeLorean to power the time machine. It seems so ridiculous. But is it any less ridiculous to turn banana peels into money? Or coffee grinds into money? Compost is actually a pretty expensive product, especially high-quality compost. And there's a lot of other product that can be made, like compost teas and extracts. Think about having, like, an integrative pest management business that utilizes the byproducts of this. So instead of selling it directly, you're selling it indirectly as a value-added service, but you're building and making your own product. Or you're hooking up with somebody locally. Like, one of the best ways to have success in a business is attach it to another business. And not necessarily through an ownership agreement or a partner, formal partnership, but as a supplier and a buyer. So if I have an existing business base and I can add a service and make more money, then I'm probably going to do it. Like, there's no easier way to grow my business than to grow my revenue per customer or my ARPU, my average revenue per user, right? That's the best and easiest way to grow and scale a business up. Acquiring a new customer takes a lot more effort than, hey, Bill, you buy from us every month anyway. Would you like to buy this too? And then we have one delivery of both products, and we just double our revenue. See how that works? So if I'm the service business, and I realize that I could be selling the fact, if I'm a organic landscaper, that we could spray this super high quality compost extract on all your fruit trees, for instance, once a month. And we'll come in and we do it at the right time of day and we spray underneath and we get the stigmata of the leaves coated and all. I'll do that. You know what I probably don't have time to do if I'm actually successful in that business, right? Then I probably don't have time to make that. Like, I have a bit, see what I'm saying? Like, businesses have to, you know, the whole thing about specialization is for insects. That's true for individuals. It's not true for businesses. The most successful businesses have a fairly narrow width of product and service that they provide. And when you get really big and they do everything, they really have divisions that act like individual companies. So if I'm in an organic landscaping business, I only probably have so much time to be doing things like making IMOs and compost extracts and stuff like that. So if I have somebody locally that I can just rely on to have enough product for me, and I have a repeatable customer schedule, and I can tell them I need 10 gallons of this a quarter, they have no problem. Then that's the best thing for them and for me. I can just focus on what I do well. I can make more money, and then my supplier has a guaranteed customer flow. That's going to keep them around. And this is something that, for all the shit we talk of corporate America, they're actually really good at this. And we are, as small business people, we tend to be arrogant and we don't think we need other people because we did it all ourselves. Yeah, but if you want to get to that next level, you have to get into some level of cooperation with adjacent businesses. Anyone can golf says, can I link to that IPM product? I cannot because I don't remember what it's called. And it was from a seminar that I attended 2 years ago. So I really don't know who makes it. I'm just telling you it's something that exists. You can try Google and you'll probably be able to find it. And again, the thing about bioreactive compost is there's some IPM built into it. Like if I go out to my composters right now and I start pulling through there's all kinds of critters in there. And almost all of them are beneficial. Almost all of them are inherently beneficial. Next, let's talk about another one, Landrace seeds. This is another thing I think that everybody should pick two or three things that you grow that you always save seed for, and you share it with the people around you until it becomes incredibly adapted to your climate type, your soil type, your climate fluctuations. Like, you can have two places that are USDA Zone 7. Because that's where I'm like 7B or 7A or something, like right on the edge of 8, right? But I'm not actually 8. I'm right on the line. And then you could take another place that's USDA Zone 7 that's like on the East Coast, and they get 5 times as much rain as I do. They never get quite as hot as I do, and they never get as arid. I don't mean dry as in lack of rain. I mean arid humidity, relative humidity. They never get as dry as I get. Even the same plant, even with the same initial seed, 5 years of that, and you have very genetically diverse products, there's probably a big opportunity to grow Landrace seeds for a region, to figure out what is really the footprint of my region, and to grow seeds and maybe create a small co-op, even if it's not legally structured as one, but you would think of it as a co-op, like, I produce these 10 seeds, Phil produces five. Tammy produces five. Debbie produces five. Now I've got, 25 seeds that are just perfect for this bioregion. And that's it. I sell this bioregion, sell these 25 plants. I want something else. Go to Burpees, go to Parks, go to all the big guys you want to. This is what we do. And once you build a book of business off of that and some repeatability, you can tell all your suppliers, this is how much I need every year. And then this is another one of those, it's a business opportunity, right? And it has the potential for massive disruption to a huge industry. But everybody can do it for themselves. If you could get just four or five neighbors doing this, and that way you could do things like, I'm going to grow this squash and you're going to grow that squash, and we'll do manual pollination so we don't get crossover. And that way we can both grow every year and we can both specialize in one of them. I'm going to grow a cucumber and you're going to grow another cucurbit that could cross-pollinate. And again, manual pollination, but I only have to manually pollinate one and you only have to manually pollinate one. There's an incredible value to that. And one of the greatest forms of wealth, we always talk about how much wealth has been taken from the American people, and it's a lot, just financial capital wealth, massive amounts stole through inflation. I want you to think about this. If the Fed actually holds inflation to what they're supposed to, 2%, over 10 years, that's 20% of your money was stolen. Okay? If you go 20 years with that, that's 40%. That's 40% on every dollar that you managed to save that you didn't blow. And the inflation itself every year makes you spend more so you save less. It's an incredible theft of wealth, isn't it? Like, think about it. For every $100,000 you make, inflation took $40,000 of it. Gee, I can't imagine why you can't get ahead, right? So we focus on that. But good Lord, how much wealth was stolen from this country when we lost all of our regionally adapted heirloom seeds that have been saved by families for years and years and years and years. And some companies, and I mean even some big ones like Burpees, have actually preserved some of these seeds, but not the way it used to be. I mean, I didn't understand the value of it, and I guess maybe not enough was done to help me understand it, or I wasn't interested, I'm not sure. But my grandfather had pepper seeds and tomato seeds. And he gave those away every year to neighbors. Nobody bought pepper seeds and tomato seeds. One of the neighbors, though, always would insist on giving my grandmother and him cucumber seeds. And we just grew their cucumber seeds. We never saved any because it was kind of understood, like, we're going to give them some and they're going to come back. We also saved green and yellow wax beans. And they were just basic seed varieties. Like, if you would have, I couldn't tell you what they were now, but now I can look back and go, but they weren't. They weren't. Simply by saving them every year, they were adapting them. I don't even know if they knew that. I think what they knew is it grew really good, so their seeds were good. I don't think my grandfather, because he never had any conversations with me about this, really understood the concept this was a land-raised seed. So think about the fact that there were literally millions of families like my grandparents at this country one time, with these land-raised seeds everywhere. Literally, you had adaptations for this side versus that side of a freaking mountain. Like, these people only live, let's say, 20 miles apart, but one's on the dry side and one's on the wet side of the mountain, and they're growing the same corn, and they were still adapted. Where is it now? Where is it now? It's gone. And it's eerily similar to what happened to our money. If you represent our money in 1913 is a dollar bill, today you have about 2 cents left. No shit. But if you represent the amount of diversity in seed that we had in 1900 and compared it today, in spite of all the work done to resurrect so much of it, it would be represented by about 2 cents. It's almost identical. It's like they stripped us equally. We can rebuild this because we have enough genetic base stock to do it. So we all should be doing it for ourselves. I think, again, this has some commercial application. But I think the commercial application is more the local producer builds their own land race so they have a more adaptable product. Or a local seed producer is providing to local producers all their seed. Again, because we only have time to do so much. But I think this is the thing that, more than anything, we should be doing it for ourselves, for our own families. And we should be passing these down again as the heirlooms and the value that they represent. I can't even let this one go without telling this story. I met a man one time that was living in Georgia. And he was growing really amazing kale and artichokes and a couple other things. And I was talking to him about the quality of it, how amazing it was. And he told me that the seed lines he was working with had come from Italy with his great-grandmother, that she brought seeds to America because they were the most valuable thing that she could bring with her other than a little bit of money. But she knew there was value in those, and they had then been handed down that long. And of course, coming from Italy over here, they probably didn't initially perform as well. But over time of continuously saving them, they had developed into this land race that worked really well in southern Georgia. Really, really interesting, I think. Okay, moving on. How about growing out of climate crops? I think this is another place with a lot of opportunity that is an example of old tech meeting new tech, because the new tech is why we can do it. Like, I grow ginger. Now, this is not a place anybody commercially grows ginger, but it could be. And I've actually developed my own method of growing ginger. I adapted a method that Curtis Stone showed in one of his videos where they were growing them in ginger in greenhouses in Canada. And that's what gave me the idea. And what they were doing, they were taking all these flats, filling them with potting soil, sticking the ginger roots in them. And as the ginger sprouted, they were breaking it off kind of like a sweet potato slip, so that one chunk of ginger, instead of making another big cluster of ginger, was making 20 new ginger plants. Well, I got a hold of this, and I adapted it into hydroponics, aquaponics, and I started taking the ginger, or just store-bought organic ginger root, breaking it into smaller pieces where you had the right nodules, and putting them about halfway into an ebb and flow bed with LECA. And very quickly, they form a little greenish-white nodule, and then it sprouts into like a little, looks like a little clump of grass. And once that nodule swells around the base to like a big, what it is a baby ginger nodule. And what happens when that big piece of root starts to re-sprout, that little nodule becomes the new root and the old root gets consumed. The plant consumes it for energy. Okay? But once you get that nodule, you just break it off, and that piece of root will often send up more of them. And you stick that back in, right next to it, into your ebb and flow bed, roots in a couple days, and then you can set it out. And so I'm able to take what they were doing and do a lot more, a lot faster, using ebb and flow in an aquaponics system. But then as long as we get that plant out at the right time, we can grow lots of ginger here. Now I don't just have ginger, though. Okay? I have ginger at maturity, regular ginger root, which is pretty expensive stuff. But it's locally produced. Well, it even has more value. But remember that little white nodule? Well, all that is it's eventually going to be a great big hand-looking ginger with the big, thick coating on it. But if you let it grow to about half of the size you would expect for a cluster to be, and pull it out of the ground, it's snow white. It does actually have a peel on it. You call it baby ginger, but the peel's so thin and soft it doesn't need to be peeled. You just scrub it, and it's ready to eat. And it's a milder, sweeter ginger with the same amount of heat to it that doesn't need to be peeled. That's baby ginger. So now I got two products, mature ginger and baby ginger, but I'm not done yet. If you've ever seen ginger grow, it almost looks like corn in some ways with its structure. It's like a grass-looking herb. Well, the round, thick, heavy part of the shaft, it tastes like ginger, but it can be used a lot like lemongrass is used. And then the leaves can be used to make teas and other things and other infusions of flavor. So now we've got four products off of one thing that's not even supposed to be able to be grown here. And we just had a guy on recently, Ryan Steva from the expert panel. He's got a customer that's growing it at a production level in Tennessee. And they are just leaving some in the ground, super deep mulch, tarping it over every winter, leaving it in the ground, pulling the tarp off in the spring, and growing it again. So there's should you do what I'm doing or what they're doing? What works for you? But this is an example now. Now let's go back to a business. Because this is a great barter item, home production. I mean, ginger is a wonderful medicinal herb. So we're back to herbs, right, as well. But it's also culinary, and it also is marketable. If you go to a grocery store and the thing you're growing is in that grocery store, that tells you it has a market or it wouldn't be there, right? If it's on the shelf at the pharmacy, it has a market or it wouldn't be there. It's a global market. That means it also has every global market also has niches, people that want something that's local. So now if I can go to a chef and say, well, I have ginger, he goes, yeah, whatever, I can get ginger, but I locally grow it. I'm a little bit interested. You know, they're doing the farm-to-table thing, but it's ginger, bro. No, you don't understand. Look what I have. And go into that chef with a little nodule of baby ginger and say, by the way, did you know you can freeze this? Ah, it's storable. Why don't you try it? See what you can do with it, what you can come up with it. Oh, see these? These shafts, right? You can use this like lemongrass, except it's ginger. What could you put on your menu with this? Oh, you can freeze those too. And then a leaf, this really needs to be used fresh, but how much do you need and when do you need it? And it can be seasonal. Now look what you've got. Or you go to a local brewery and you say, do you guys do a special run every year of the big bottles of you only make so many cases of it. And most of the craft breweries do stuff like that. What about a ginger beer from locally produced ginger? It's another potential where maybe you have two customers and that's it. That's all you grow for. Especially if you have other customers for other things. It's okay to have a customer that's buying one or two products from you. There's nothing wrong with that. You want to eventually sell them more, but what a great lead in. And how much, the number one thing you want in sales, and it doesn't matter what you're selling, a unique lead in that's hard to find and has a hook. So I'll take it to something totally different. Go back to the 1990s, early 2000s. Before I went to work for Fluke, I worked for a company called Garrett. We made Ethernet equipment, switches, hubs, stuff like that, right? Media converters, the whole nine. So did 9 million other companies. But we had two things that when I would pick up the phone, as long as I could get past the freaking gatekeeper to an engineer in a telecom-based company, that they would at least take a meeting with me. We had the option for negative 48 volt DC power, which all the telcos used, right? All the central offices used, and we were something called NEB certified, which basically means that the company spent a lot of money to have the equipment tested to meet the NEB certification, which any equipment in a central office with a carrier had to be NEB certified. When it came to Ethernet, there was us and there was Cisco that had both of those things. And everything else, it was NEB certified. You had to do some sort of power conversion to get it to run off the native 48 volt negative power systems of the telcos. So I could get somebody from Santerra Systems or Alcatel or Pathnet or whatever on the phone and say, would you like to see an Ethernet switch that's negative 48 volt and NEB certified? And they say, we have that now, Cisco. I'm like, well, what else do you have? And there is nothing else. Well, I have it. Would you like me to bring one in for you to look at? And and explain the whole line to you. And we're modular and we do all these things. And they would be like, yeah, even if they weren't enthusiastic, I'll take a look at that. That's the lead in to have something that is so unique, but not so unique that nobody wants it. Right? So if you're I have carved poop on a stick, there's no other thing like it in the world. Well, yeah, there's a reason nobody wants it. But when you take something that already has a market and you create a unique niche with it, you can move it into that market. So I think there's a lot of different out-of-climate crops, things that we can grow locally that we think we cannot. And whether we do that through geothermic greenhouses, wallapenis, whether we do that through just indoor growing, normal greenhouses with some sort of supplemental heat, there's a lot of ways that taking a biochar production facility with big, giant, like 10-yard biochar kilns that heat water in an open-loop system and pump the water through tubes in the ground inside the greenhouse a foot deep underneath the roots of the plants that you're growing. Well, that sounds complicated. Yeah, Bob Wells in New England Biochar did that shit in the Carolinas. They have a whole setup of multi-acre greenhouses that do exactly that, and they have peppers in their fourth year of production without being replanted. So that's growing in climate, out of climate. How the hell do I mean by that? Peppers are perennial. The reason you don't think they're perennial is because if you live anywhere where it freezes every year, they all die. But a pepper is not an annual plant. It's a short-lived perennial. And when I say short-lived, 5 to 10 years, depending on the race of the pepper. And probably can be longer than that with certain things like pruning acting like coppicing a tree, because a pepper is not really an herb plant. It's not an herbaceous plant. It's a shrub. It's a bush. So what they, when I say in climate, out of climate, what I mean is it's very normal for farmers in the Carolinas to grow peppers. What's not normal is to keep the plant alive for multiple seasons. There's a lot of advantages about this, okay, that people don't initially realize. Well, you don't have to plant it every year. You have a labor savings. Oh, that's just, that's nice. That's icing on the cake. No, what's really going to happen is by keeping that plant alive, even if it's non-productive, January, February, what happens to that plant when the day starts to lengthen and the temperature comes up in the greenhouse in March? And it's already got a root system this big. And my competitor at the greenhouse down the road is putting a little bitty pepper plant in the ground for the first year. I'm in production faster. My plants produce more, my plants produce larger, and my plants will last longer, and so my production is much more spread out. It starts earlier, and it ends later, and I have greater overall production. And that's in, you know, that's in climate, out of climate at the same time. And there's a lot of, we can grow turmeric. There's so many things that we think of as being tropical-produced things that we could be producing locally. With the right greenhouse, tamarillo is another excellent example. Don't tell me you can't sell that to a chef. Most of them don't even know what one is. And I'll tell you how you get a chef on board. You take them something that's really good that they've never seen before. And you say, taste it. What would you do with it? You can even go very low pressure sales. What would you do with it? I mean, tell them, like, I know you're a chef, and even if you don't want to buy this from me, like, I produce a lot of this. And I'd like to come up with some other ways to use it. Go to ChatGPT, use the CRIT method, context, role, interview, task. Give them the product that you want to sell to a chef. Make the GPT a chef that's the kind of chef you want to sell to, and ask it what you would do with it, and then take that idea to your chef. Just, I'll tell you one thing about selling to chefs, be careful. If you go too far with the idea, they don't want it because they want to do it themselves. Right? They don't want to be told what to do with an ingredient, but like I was kind of thinking like this and that, and I don't know, would that be a good idea? That's how you pitch a recipe to a chef. Not all chefs are arrogant, but many of them are, right? They're not all Gordon Ramsay level, but there's a certain level of, I don't even, arrogance is the right word. Very confident in their own ability, and they want to feel like they created a thing. So you bring them the thing, you created it, I want to create it for myself. But if you say, I don't know if that's a good idea or not, actually, that's really good, but if you were to do this, this, and, oh, that would be cool. How many of them do you want? How many of them do you want? There's so much like that. Plus, again, being able to produce this type of thing for ourselves is value. And it also gives us more regional resilience. Because when you rely on something that comes from Brazil or Hawaii, like ginger does, then you're dependent on this long chain of distribution. The more we can bring local, the better. We're probably never going to efficiently grow coffee anywhere that's not in the tropics. You're just not. It can be done, but it's almost a heroic effort. But you can grow so much ginger, it's unbelievable. You'd be shocked how much ginger you can grow. Or again, turmeric, or many of these other things that we think of as normally not being suitable to grow in temperate climates. Then I got one more for you, and this one is high tech, but it can fit into a lot of these others. And that is Bitcoin Lightning applications. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that Bitcoin just hit a new all-time high. I think it got close to 123,000. The last time I checked it, it dropped back down to like 120,000 overnight, and that's typical of how it moves. But as of this morning, Bitcoin was the fifth largest asset in the world. The fifth largest asset by market cap in the world. Last night, it ate Amazon. Bitcoin had I think that right now they're like neck and neck. It's like if Bitcoin goes up a dollar, it moves back to number five, and Amazon does down to six. And if Bitcoin goes down a dollar, it just flips. It's that close. But it's going to permanently take over that position, and it's going to keep going. So Bitcoin is the money of the future. I don't care how tired of me saying it you are. All you've done by resisting it since I started talking about in 2013 was make yourself poor. I'm not going to apologize for talking about it. I told you I would never let it go because I knew it would never go away, that it was something to bet on with the odds fully in your favor. And if you ignored it, it would be a bad decision for this day and age. And that has proven itself to be true. And that's not over yet. It's only just begun. It is very, very early. So the Bitcoin itself is going to become this incredible commodity that will in time become the primary monetary base unit for cash settlement in the world. That doesn't mean all your purchases will be in it. What it means is final settlement will be in it. It will be the gold of the future. That's what I mean. When people say it's digital gold, people think that they mean digital gold, like the kind of gold your boomer grandpa bought in the 90s and the 2000s to put in a box. That's what they think you mean. I mean, and what we mean in the community is digital gold, is the way the Rockefellers use gold when the gold standard was in effect and gold was cash settlement at the end of batch transactions, but what the banks were trading was sovereign debt. That's what I mean by digital gold. So, but how does that play into this disruptive technology? Lightning enables things that really there's no other way to do them. The micropayments are interesting, but what's really more interesting to me is we have a peer-to-peer payment system that completely avoids the need for a bank. But more importantly, it's permissionless. Yeah, it's very low fee. That's great. That's wonderful. It's super fast. And if you think about Lightning and what I said with sovereign debt, and then you think of be your own banker, that's exactly what it is. Lightning is trading obligations that are finalized, and the final settlement back on chain would be your cash settlement. And so we're batching transactions. If I'm in a business, I don't need every transaction immediately final settled. I don't get that with credit cards anyway. I pay them a big fee, 3%. And my actual settlement on any transaction is 72 to 96 hours later. And the customer can always lie. And if I get charged back, it's actually very hard to beat it. It sucks. Like, this is why a lot of, you know, there was a lot more resistance to credit cards when they really started becoming mainstream and everybody was using them than there is now. Like, now it's just kind of an accepted, begrudging thing it has to be. But merchants know, one, somebody could give you, like, back when my dad had a gas station in the 80s, like, he got bad credit cards every once in a while. I mean, like probably once a week you'd get a bad card. That was back in the days where you did the slidey thing. It wasn't immediately checked and all. And they got past that. But there's still this like, okay, now you have this. The bank owes you money is the way that it works. So if I batch my Lightning settlements as a business every 3 or 4 days, I'm still getting final settlement just as fast. But I can use it in Lightning form immediately. So I kind of have both at the same time. But what's more important than all of that is it's permissionless. Anybody can build anything on it. Anything you heard today that you're like, I can think of a technology to actually empower that and make trade of it quicker, faster, and better. If you do it with Visa or MasterCard or Amex or Discover, there's a certain, you need a merchant account. You need a permission to do it. You can build anything on Lightning right now. You can build anything on Bitcoin right now. You can build anything on other layered solution right now, like Fediment. You can build your own layered solution right now. Now, I know that is high tech. You have to know how to lay down code, but you don't have to be technical to use it. People keep saying, well, I don't understand Bitcoin. There's no way I could use it. I don't understand it. You use every email every day. Do you understand SMTP? Do you understand POP? Use the internet every day. Use Ethernet every day. Do you understand TCP/IP? Right? You go on WordPress websites every day and consume content. Do you understand PHP? Many of you run WordPress websites. Do you understand PHP? And MySQL? No. The whole thing, the whole engine that runs WordPress, that's it. There's other things, but that's the primary engine. You don't have to know how a tech works to use it. You have to know how tech works to build it and maintain it and work on it. Most of you don't know how your car works. Most of you don't. At least in this audience, there's probably a lot of people who could at least change their own oil or maybe swap a part or something like that. But if I actually said, explain to me exactly how an internal combustion engine works, what the four strokes are, right? How many of them actually produce power? What's the difference between a two-stroke engine in your car, a four-stroke engine in your car versus like a two-stroke engine in an old motorcycle? Well, one's four and one's two. Yeah, but what does it mean? Most of you don't know. Now, some of you are like, I know. Well, okay, you know. But you get my point. Like, all those people drive cars. They don't know how it works. How's your catalytic converter work? Many of you even know what it does, but how does it work? I don't know. They put it on a car and I drive it around and the emissions are supposedly better for the planet or whatever, right? If it doesn't get stolen, it works, right? You don't have to know how, so you don't have to know all kinds of shit about Bitcoin to use it. It's really, really, I like that. Suburban Homestead Outfitters. Here's your four strokes. Suck, squeeze, bang, blow. I'm not going to even translate it. That's absolutely, completely correct. I've never heard it put that way, but that's completely correct. Suck, squeeze, bang, blow. Anyway, the beauty with Bitcoin and specifically Lightning is that we haven't even begun to understand the applications that are going to integrate it. And what we're going to see is a combination of technologies like above phone, where you have private app marketplaces where no one can control the app in the first place, and building it into those. But you're going to see more and more what we call web apps, which is, if you have an iPhone and you log into a website and it has certain features that it provides you, and if there's the ability to buy things in it, the reason a lot of stuff isn't in the App Store for purchase is because Apple takes 25% of in-app purchases. Well, there's a lot of things that really blows up the business model for it. It doesn't really work. Or it pushes the margins down, then you have to get approved. Building the app is really expensive. And at any time, Apple or Google could just decide, we don't like you. We're going to turn off your app. We're a web app, basically, on an iPhone. You open the page where your account is, right, in Safari, and you basically create an icon that goes on the screen of your phone. And then you're into the app, even though it's just basically accessed through the browser. So that's going to become more and more prevalent. Now, I want you to think about something else. We already have apps like Strike. And since Strike is just sending and receiving money, like PayPal is, though Bitcoin's invoked in it, right? There's no purchases in Strike. Strike is used for purchases. You got it? But what do we know about Strike? I can hold dollars. And I can pay somebody in Bitcoin. I can hold dollars and I can pay somebody in Lightning. Okay, if Strike can do that, literally anybody else can do that. Square, Block, Zelle, name it. All of them can do that. And all of them are beginning to come up with methods like that. Why does this really matter? Because you could create apps that allow purchases of things, specifically digital goods, that, yes, the receiver will need to be able to receive Bitcoin. But the buyer is anybody. Just like right now, if you're going to buy something online, you have to have like a PayPal account or a credit card or one of the other payment methods, Google Pay, something like that, right? So you're never going to get to a point where somebody that doesn't have anything can buy something from somebody that wants to sell it over the internet. But with Lightning, you can get to the point where your customer doesn't even need to know Bitcoin's involved. Now, why is this? What's the most important piece of this? So that I can build a platform, and when I say I mean anybody, can build some sort of a platform service app that allows the customer, without understanding it's what they're doing, to immediately pay me as the application service provider and the seller at the same time. With Lightning, what we can do is, let's say I charge 10% fees for all sales through my app, or 5%, whatever it is. You buy something, and I'm going to use sats, so I'm going to use dollars. We're going to say it's 5%. $10 sale, I charge 50 cents. I can't do it with a credit card. I can't do it with a credit card. Plus the amount of bullshit it opens up, right? So now I have to collect all the money and pay it out to you. So now I've got tax implications. I'm doing accounting for you, all of this stuff. Watch how it works with Lightning. Bill wants to buy something. You're selling sweet potato slips, right, for $10 a bundle. And then you say, order, send $10, right? The $10 leaves as dollars from Bill's Strike account. And it becomes Lightning Bitcoin on the way. But when it arrives to its first address, it's a programmed address that says, take this money and send $9.50 onto this address and 50 cents onto that address. Okay, I'm not responsible for your income. I'm not responsible for reporting your sales. I never touched your money. The only thing I got was the 50 cents. That's it. I don't even have to know you. I don't have to know anything about you. I probably don't want to know. The less I know about you, the better. And since all the payments are in Lightning, it's really blind to surveillance on the backside. It's up to you how you want to handle your taxes as a legitimate business. I would, of course, report the money received. And it can just as easily be converted back to dollars if that's what I want. If you do it right, there's no reason we shouldn't be able to do this. Bob says, I want, of my $9.50, I want $1.50 in Bitcoin and the rest of it in dollars so I can keep my business running on cash flow. Now you really have the ability to empower a small business to be a micro Bitcoin treasury company. And no one needs a damn thing to do with Bitcoin to buy from you. And because this is the momentum and where it's going, all that's going to increase. I don't think you're going to have any forms of these online payment methods in another few years where sending Bitcoin won't be an option from dollars. Not a single one of them. Because the ones that don't are going to be a lot less likely to get used. And that split payment capacity is something that's had a lot of promise, but that's where it really is building, especially tech platforms that sell digital goods that allow the platform provider to take a piece without having all their profit eaten or having to take so much. The seller's like, screw this, man. I don't want to do this. Like any of you sell through Etsy or eBay or anything like that, you might feel like, man, they take a really big piece. Go try to do it and you'll see why. But what if you could make all of the complexities go away? Now blend it with all this other low tech. So final thoughts today. Bridging high tech and low tech creates real resilience and freedom. Like I said, everything I gave you today, you can just use for yourself. You don't need a business. Or you can use two or three of them and that's all you want. But if you get your neighbor using one or two and your other neighbor using one or two and trade amongst yourselves, you have even more power and more resilience locally. Each of these tools scales up and down depending on your goals and context. You can grow enough ginger for yourself or enough ginger for you and your neighbor or enough ginger for you and five restaurants. It's up to you, and you have control over the scalability. You can do the same thing with mushrooms. You can do the same thing with just about any of these technologies you have today. And you don't have to choose between digital leverage and analog. This is a time we're entering into the synthesis of both. And I'll just talk about a few more ways to connect the dots here. So I mentioned that I have a listener named Tyler who's emailed me a bit about trying to help me with my mushroom work. And he's a guy, he's near Philadelphia. And he goes through 80 blocks, mushroom spawn blocks, a day he has to get rid of. He's like, anybody will come up here and get them, I'll give them to you. Okay, and I'm telling you, there are a lot of people like that. Most of these mushroom guys are doing one and done on their blocks, and they might come up with stuff to do with them at first, and then you realize, like, I just can't, I got to get rid of it. Even if they're composting or whatever, like, they can only deal with so much. 80 blocks, You know, if they're 5-pound blocks, and he's doing, I think, 14-pound blocks. But, I mean, you're talking somewhere around 400 pounds to 800 pounds of material a day. You go a week, go a month with that. You're talking literal tons of material that has to be gotten rid of. So that's available and willing to be got away. What if you went into the composting business, but your primary composting feedstock was spent mushroom blocks? What if you had kind of like a small mushroom business where you're re-flushing the blocks once before composting them? How many different ways can you come up with to do that? What if you were feeding mushroom compost to worms? Because let me tell you something. They really, really, really like it. They really like it. What if you were building garden beds for people? You were a local garden designer and installer, but you were seeding the garden beds with mushroom blocks. That's just one tech and how many places you can find overlaps for it. How much could you do if you really started thinking about how to tie all these technologies together and started, again, building kind of a regional cell-based network of people working together? Anyway, with that, I am ready to wrap up. I want to thank you guys for tuning in today. Hope it was a good liftoff to your Monday morning. And today I have as an item of the day for you a product I've brought around quite a bit, but it's on sale again, so I thought I'd bring it around for you today. The Frigidaire Portable Ice Maker. We have several of these because we bought multiples for our workshops and stuff. They're on sale today for $87. This is a super simple unit. You don't have to have any, you know, like high tech knowledge to use it or anything like that. All you do is you open it after you plug it in, of course, and you pour water into the fill line. You put the basket block in and you close it and it makes ice. The ice is not, it's not a freezer. So you can either take it out, put it in bags and put it in your freezer, or just leave it. Most of the time we just leave ours run. And when the ice melts, the water goes back into the reservoir and it makes more ice. It's just recirculating constantly. It's very low energy draw. It's, you can run this easily off like a 400 watt inverter in your car. So it is a prepper item. It can keep medical supplies and food from spoiling during an outage because you can run it with almost no energy at all. Ice is, I mean, think about what gets cleaned out during disasters. Ice machines and bottled water get cleared out. You can, as long as you have water, you can make all the ice you want with an inverter. It's a great product. And again, it's on sale today for $87. The longest I've had one in operation now is 4 years. It still works perfectly. Still works perfectly. Thank you as well, King of Biltong. But I do have a few questions I'm going to hit. I think three is what I have here. If you, I'm going to real quick put them up on the screen. I got one from Richard. I got one from James. And I got one from Seiko Mag. So if you don't see your question there and you're still here, you have until I'm done answering these three to get it up on the board. Richard says, I find that specific spices taste better when I have a micronutrient deficiency. My body will crave a fresh herb. That's, it's not really a question, it's more of a statement. Well, it says comment, so my bad. But that's very interesting, and I think that's very true. That if you start like really craving something, it may in fact have a nutrient. Think about how we handle cattle with free choice minerals. You'll put out multiple buckets of specific micronutrients, and the cattle will naturally take from the ones that they need. I got to believe our intrinsic intelligence is at least as high as a cow's. So I think that's really interesting. James White says, how sturdy are the spent blocks? I'm curious if I could add them to my hydro setup. I do hydrogen, so I wouldn't be putting the block chunks in straight liquid. I don't know how that would work. I think they're very sturdy, but they're not going to stay that way when they're fully hydrated because it's basically compressed sawdust. And when you make them in the beginning, before the mycelium spreads, they'll crumble right apart. And even once the mycelium spreads, they're pretty easy to break up. So I just don't know that that would be a really great use for them. Breaking them up and composting them, breaking them up and putting them into garden paths in between the beds, breaking them up and putting them in the beds and mulching over them, that type of thing, breaking them up and putting them in a potted plant and mulching over them, all of those things work. Burying whole blocks works really well as well, James. But I don't think it would work really well in Leica. I think it's just going to apart. If you've ever seen
wood pellets, because that's what most of them, these blocks are made out of. If you've ever seen wood pellets get wet, they just come apart. Seiko Mag says, what would you think the next low might be for Bitcoin, still new to this? So the answer is I have no idea. No one else does either. I saw John Dowley today say in the TSP Workshops Telegram group, well, when it goes down to 60 in this next cycle, and I'm like, I posted a, you know, the GIF of the skeleton, like, you know, laying back on the bench. It said, people waiting to buy Bitcoin when it goes down. We have no idea. There is a four-year cycle that has been fairly repeatable, and this is heading into the last high of the cycle, so much so that people literally use things like October, right? October for October, because usually in this part of the cycle, October is where it goes parabolic. And then usually it'll sustain itself in November. It kind of levels out and it begins to decline into and starts the next cycle. But we've never had certain things that we have this time before, not even close. We've never had ETFs before. That could go two ways. That's a lot of Bitcoin that can be sold really, really easily and fast. And a lot of it is inside of tax-deferred accounts where it can be done without tax consequences, and everybody knows the pattern now. So there could be some big sell-offs as we go into that parabolic high at the end of the cycle. But there's also a lot of money that's in, like, most people in those tax-deferred accounts and all, they don't do a lot of trading. That's you keep just adding money, and you have an allocation, right? So that should stabilize it. But what we also never had before was company after company after company putting Bitcoin on the company's balance sheet with the plan for Bitcoin to be part of the long-term strategic outlook of the company, and more companies coming into it. And companies, like I said earlier, you gotta cooperate with other companies. These billionaires are starting to talk to each other and go, look, man, if one of us does this, there is some downside risk. And Michael Saylor's going, not me, baby. I'm good for 30 years if Bitcoin goes to 60,000 and stays there for 30 years. So I don't care. But I'm interested anyway because I'll benefit from this too. So come on and tell me what you got. So you have, like, you know, the people behind 21 Capital, like Jack Mahlers and Cantor Fitzgerald and all, realizing, like, if 10 big companies start doing this at the industrial scale, they create a floor. And then they can build their entire business model off, this is our new floor, and they can keep pushing the floor up. So we've never had that concept, but we're moving real close from where that concept becomes a reality. Now, if you get nation states, like this strategic Bitcoin reserve that Trump keeps talking about, once any nation in earnest that's not, you know, El Salvador was great for emotion, but El Salvador has 6 million people. Dallas-Fort Worth has 6 million people. You understand what I'm saying? Like, El Salvador is not even equivalent to a large U.S. state from a GDP standpoint, right? Texas is like the 11th largest country in the world by GDP standards, right? California is like up there too. El Salvador is like way down in the double digits, right? As to, maybe even below double digits, right? Maybe triple digits globally. But you get an actual nation state, a G20 nation, putting it on a balance sheet, then everybody else has to do it too. We're very close to the potential of that careening over the cliff. So all of those things together means you might have a muted drop this time. And I'm going to tell you, you're going to have muted, just how muted. But you may not have much of a drop cycle at all. I'm not saying you might not drop like 10 points, but that's a daily thing with Bitcoin. I'm talking these huge pullbacks, you know, 70, 80%. Even if we're going to have that, if I told you the down now, I'd have to know the up. So the last cycle, and this is, I think it really clicked for people because this is like the fourth time I've done it where I've been able to say this is what's going to happen. The last cycle, I said, we just hit the high. It's over. Your bottom's going to be 14.4, and I think we hit like 15.1. Wow. Like, just math. To even guess that way, though, we have to see what the cycle top's going to be. My gut, 250-ish. And I know right now that sounds crazy because that's more than 100,000 in gain. But a double right now is 240. And for Bitcoin to double from the summer to the fall of the end of a cycle, that is not that even like there's occurrences that are way beyond that, way beyond just a double. There's 3X, 4X, 5X, 7X. 2016, 2017 was like a 7X at this juncture, between this juncture and the end of that cycle, was like a 7X. So double is nothing, and double puts you there. That's why I think it's most likely. Now, I will tell you this, for those who don't follow me on X, first of all, you should, and you'd know more about, because that's where I do most of my discussion about Bitcoin. I posted on June the 20th. I'll look it up right here, right? I've got the receipts. I might as well show them. I posted on, let me see here. Right here. Okay. I posted on June 25, 2005, right? So about 20 days ago. I don't post a lot of targets, but I'm saying right now, 115K Bitcoin minimum before August, minimum, more likely well into the 120s. It was not exactly well received when I posted it as being, you know, a Spirko Domus level thing. I think now it is. And I think it's just that I can tell you a lot of times what I think is going to happen, and I can be very accurate, but I can't go in March of 2020. I don't know yet. So this is why I take the approach that I do, the sailor approach. I'll be buying the top forever, Laura. So well, you should be buying when it's down. I'll do that too. If I'm buying it all the time, I'm DCAing. And what I'll do, because I'm not a billionaire, is I'll buy, you know, $10 a day. $5 a day, whatever works for you. Through Strike, throw a couple $100 in every month and divide by 30 and set a daily buy and just let it go on autopilot. And every month, refill it with whatever your monthly buy is going to be. And that way you're buying bing, 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 bing all the way through. And yes, if we get into another accumulation trough, if we get like if 2026 comes and there's some major sell off and Bitcoin's down to like 54,000, if you're like, what are you going to do now, Jack? Buy more? Double my daily buy while it's down here until it goes back up. Like, I'm not worried about it anymore. And I think this is the only real winning play with it now. I didn't mean to turn the end of this into like a little mini Bitcoin breakout, but it's pretty exciting. It's pretty exciting to watch Bitcoin go from it's tulip mania to the fifth largest asset on the planet. And guys, you know what it's doing? It's just killing them off one at a time. I made this little meme today, and if you want to see it, I'm not going to explain it to you guys who are on the audio only. I'm just going to put it up for you guys that are on video right now, right? Who's next? Who's next, Apple, right? Because that's who's next. After Amazon, it's Apple. But if you want to see the meme, you're going to have to come to 1 hour, 52 minutes, and 50 seconds into the video. Which you can find either on the YouTube channel or embedded in the show notes. With that, in the show notes, all the resources I promised, including contact information for the gentleman in Philadelphia with the blocks. I said I would put that in last week. I also had people ask me last week about the Friday flashback and all. Last week, I was burnt by the end of the week, guys. It really was. So I didn't do a Friday flashback. I'm going to consider it an optional thing to do going forward. Some weeks, I'm just going to be too tired for it. But and also some other things got left out. And then the Jeff Lawton podcast went like 3 hours. And I did two podcasts in one day. Both are interviews. Kind of wears you out. So I'm sorry if I wasn't quite 100% on point last week. But we'll try to make it up to you this week. Take care, guys. Catch you tomorrow with another one. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month.